Thank you very much, Olu. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone. Welcome to today's Privacy and Proxy Services Accreditation Issues PDP Working Group call on Tuesday, the 3rd of November at 1500 UTC. On today's call, we have Frank Mishlick, Graham Bunton, Griffin Barnett, James Bladel, Kathy Clayman, Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, Thor Corwin, Sarah Bocchi, Sarah Wild, Stephanie Perrin, Steve McAllitz, Susan Kawaguchi, Terry Stummer, Todd Williams, and Vicky Schlecker. Apologies noted from Holly Raich, Michaeli Nalon, and Don Blumenthal. And from staff on today's call, we have Mary Wong and myself, Steve LeGruber. I hope I haven't left anyone off the list. And over to you, Steve. Or if I could just remind everyone to please state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you, and over to you, Steve.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. I'm glad that we all seem to have made it safely back from Dublin. And I think we had a good, productive face-to-face meeting there that generated some forward momentum. So our immediate challenge is to maintain that and press ahead to finish up our work. Mary circulated an agenda, which I hope could be posted on the screen. At least I'm not seeing it on my screen. But I'm sure it starts with any updates to SOIs that people want to emphasize. Okay, hearing none, we'll go ahead into the agenda. We have a couple of documents to review that were circulated last night. The first one is on your screen. The second one will be on your screen after we get through the first one. And then we have, I think James had any other business item that he wanted to raise, so we'll make sure to reserve some time at the end for that. But the two documents are our first proposed revised text for deaccreditation and possible data escrow recommendation, which, again, these are items that were discussed in Dublin, and there was a feeling that we needed to address some of these questions a little more directly. And then we have some output from Subteam 3 from the illustrative disclosure framework that we'll move, which was obviously a subject of quite a bit of our discussion in Dublin, and I know that subteam has been hard at work since Dublin, so we'll go over where they are with that. So why don't we go right to this first document, and it really addresses, I think it addresses two issues. One is the point that comes up in a number of places about the implementation challenges of applying the accreditation framework to service providers that aren't affiliated with or aren't controlled by accredited registrars. I think most of what we've done will work reasonably well for affiliated registrars, but there are some areas where an unaffiliated registrar could run into some difficulties, and a few of those are mentioned in this statement. And then one particular area about deaccreditation and how this affects customers, I know was emphasized in Dublin, and this paper attempts to summarize that discussion and in the form of conclusion. So, Mary, could I ask you to just walk through this document quickly for the benefit of the working group so that we can get reactions to it?
Sure. Thanks, Steve, and hello, everybody. Steve's already summarized the genesis of this document and the problem that we were trying to address while staying on course for policy recommendations and not delving too deep into implementation details, specifically on the deaccreditation side. And actually, to James's point that will come up in AOB, I should note here that the initial recommendations our group had for deaccreditation were the group of comments that my operational colleagues had the greatest number of comments and concerns about, which is one reason why we raised them in Dublin. So this document, and specifically the principles, which are three principles here you see on the screen and what was circulated last night, tries to address that following the working group's agreement in Dublin that in view of the operational issues, it may be better to create several overarching principles to guide staff and the implementation review team. So the three principles do try to take into account that agreement, as well as some of the more specific issues and topics that working group members felt would be important in developing these principles. So principle one talks about the notification of a customer. Principle two talks about the need to really try to minimize the risk of having a customer's personal details published as in the course of the accreditation. And of course, thirdly, we reiterate the point that the problems may be different when a provider is affiliated versus one who's not affiliated. And in this particular respect, you notice in this document and throughout the report, we use the word affiliated with a capital A, and we do note elsewhere in the report that this is used in the same sense as in the RAA. The last part of this document is a separate recommendation, which actually is one that was already made in our initial report, but because it was made as part of the deaccreditation section, we felt we should retain this for continuity, and that is a relationship to the upcoming review of the IRTP. So, Steve, I don't propose to read all the principles, but hopefully that summary is useful for folks as you review this document and perhaps provide your comments here orally and any follow-ups by email. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Mary. And I do think this this captures some of the discussion in Dublin and highlights some issues that are important to include in our final report. Let me ask if people have questions about this document or comments on it. We can open a queue for that now. Are there any questions or comments about this proposed text that was circulated yesterday? Okay, hearing none and knowing that this did just arrive in your inboxes yesterday, let me ask that if you have any questions or comments, please bring those to the list, and if you can, do so by the end of your day on Thursday, which is the 5th, as we're hoping to fold this into the final draft of the report by the end of this week. I see James has a hand up, so let me turn to him.
Hi, Steve. James speaking, and sorry for the delayed reaction there. I was trying to find my hand raise button. I just wanted to say I'm on board with these principles in this document. I do want to give it a more thorough review, but one thing that I think is perhaps needs to be explored, and maybe we kick this over to the implementation discussion, is whether or not there is a window between notification and actual deaccreditation and I guess this is more, I think about it, this is an implementation concern, where there's a window that allows the customers to choose what fate will become of their private information, whether it's published, whether they move it to another provider that's unaffiliated, or whether they transfer to a registrar provider combination service. So I'll drop my hand now, and we'll just maybe put a button in that for implementation talks.
Okay. Thank you, James. Let me see if there's anybody else that would like to be in the queue. And if you're not in the Adobe room, just speak up if you want to be in the queue. Okay. Well, then we'll close that agenda item. And as I said, please provide any further comments or questions as soon as you can. No later than Thursday, so that we can fold this into the final draft. Okay, the next agenda item is the continued discussion of the illustrative disclosure framework, and again, a document was circulated last night, and just to reiterate what was in Mary's cover note on this, this looks a lot more marked up than perhaps it should be, in the sense that most of the changes in here were already on the table and were discussed in Dublin. So Mary has kind of highlighted two or three areas where there are new changes that have emerged since in the discussions in Subteam 3 since Dublin, and I think we should probably focus our discussion today on those. So we have several members of the subteam here. If I can ask Todd to kick off the discussion here and just kind of identify for us the main changes that are reflected in here since the Dublin meeting, and then we can discuss those. So I think that's the best way to proceed. So let me call on Todd, and then followed by other members of the subgroup.
Thanks, Steve. Todd Williams for the transcript. And just in terms of how to go about talking about these, I would break them down into two broad categories. And we have not discussed this internally, but if it's okay with Kathy, I would suggest that I'll kind of take the first and then she take the second in terms of walking the working group through what we've done. The first is changes that we made to the document based specifically on discussions that we had in Dublin in the face-to-face. And those are all included within Section 3, and I'll walk through them. The second broad category are changes to the document based on the annex to the annex. And as the working group will recall, there were essentially two options for that annex, and we've changed some language on the second option and have gone back into the first part of the document because certain changes to that annex will require certain insertions back in the actual text of the document in Section 2, but I'll let Kathy kind of walk through that. So with specific respect to changes made to the document based on the discussions in Dublin, as I said, they're in Section 3. The first is in 3A, and this was based on some conversation as to how 3A relates to 3C6, and specifically we've added this language, so long as doing so will not endanger the safety of the customer as outlined in Section 3C6. And so if you'll recall in Dublin, there were concerns raised about what the provider discloses to the requester and whether certain information being disclosed short of the actual contact information could endanger the safety of the customer, and basically trying to make sure that 3A and 3C6 kind of work in tandem. And so that's what that language is meant to do. The second is in 3B, and it's changing calendar days to business days, and then changing one calendar day to two business days. And again, that was based on what we talked about. Going down still, 3C4, if you recall, we had a couple different alternatives in terms of language based on whether this particular surrender option was in fact an option or was required. We've now solidified it as an option. And then there is a new 3C7. This was based on the concern that Volker raised and that we had talked about in Dublin, making explicit that if the requester simply fails to provide any of the information or the elements that are required previously in the document in Section 2, that the provider can refuse to disclose based on that failure. Again, you know, as we discussed, this was kind of implicit in the structure of the document, and 3C7 now just makes it explicit. So those are kind of the changes to the document based on what we talked about in Dublin, and I would propose that we kind of go over those if anybody has any concerns. We talk about them before we move to the other changes in the annex.
Okay, thank you very much, Todd. So these are all changes in Section 3, which is basically on pages 7 and 8 of the document that's in front of you, and we can open a queue for questions, comments, or concerns about those changes. Are there any comments on this? I'll put myself in the queue first while others are gathering their thoughts. So in terms of the first change, this is about what the customer is supposed to provide to the provider. A complaint comes in, the provider sends it to the customer promptly and asks the customer to respond. And the customer responds if it thinks there are legitimate reasons to object to disclosure, then the customer has to tell that to the provider and authorize the provider to communicate that to the requester. That's kind of where we started in this. And then you have we added a parenthetical here, so long as it won't, doing so will not endanger the safety of the customer, as outlined, you know, in the section below about a ground for refusal. So this is something that's communicated by the customer to the provider. Now, this still leaves the provider with the obligation if it is going to deny the request, if the request meets all the requirements in Section 2, and if it's going to deny the request, it still has to state a reason for that. Am I correct in that? This doesn't change that. It just it makes it clear, you know, that the customer could tell the provider, don't pass along what I'm saying to you to the requester because I feel like it would endanger my safety. But still, there's a requirement to state a reason. Have I correctly summarized that?
So this is Todd for the transcript, and I'll just say yes, unless anybody else wants to jump in. That's exactly, as you outlined it, is exactly the purpose of that language.
Okay, great. Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. Are there others who want to comment or ask questions about the three changes that Todd just walked through? If not, then as Todd has suggested, shall we turn to Kathy to walk us through the changes to the annex and any other conforming changes resulting from that. So we're basically looking, I think, here at page 9 of the document. James, did you have a question about?
Yes.
First part.
Yeah, thanks for speaking with a quick question. This doesn't preclude or eliminate any option where the service provider customer responds directly to the complainant, right? It's not a forced relay on the part of the provider. And I apologize, it's been a while since I've looked at this.
Yeah. I don't think anything in here prevents that.
Okay, I don't know if we need to explicitly state that or not, but we can leave that option on the table, that'd be great.
I'll ask the any sub-team members that want to comment on that.
So this is Todd. I'll just go quickly. Nothing in this framework precludes that kind of direct communication between the customer and the requester, should the customer so choose. Again, the framework is meant as to what are the obligations of the provider when they've received a request that meets the elements outlined in Section 2. To the extent that the customer wants to essentially short-circuit that process and go directly to the requester, they're certainly free to do so.
Okay. Thank you. Phil Corwin is in the queue. Anybody else want to comment or ask questions here? Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, Steve, I may have further comments in writing. I just want to understand how this works. On page 2, under 2A, it refers to situations where a domain name allegedly infringes a trademark, which, of course, is what can give rise to a UDRP or URS. And then later on, it says the requester will submit in C there on page 3 to court jurisdiction, no reference to UDRP or URS action. And then on page 8, I'm just scrolling down. Yeah, it says that under D near the bottom, that disclosure can't be refused solely for lack of civil action or UDRP or URS. I just want to say, in a situation where, I understand if the domain name is identical to a registered, unique registered trademark, but if it's a generic word or if it's confusingly similar, what's the latitude here if the registrant says, you know, my domain is not identical to a trademark, and I've got, I believe I would prevail in a UDRP or URS or a court action. Is that sufficient? How does that work vis-a-vis the disclosure decision? It's not clear to me how all that works.
I think the answer to that can be found, again, on that page in Section 3, where one of the reasons for refusal is that the customer has provided a basis for reasonably believing it's not infringing the requester's claimed intellectual property rights. That's C, Romanet.
Okay, I see that. Okay.
I think that's the answer, but I will defer to anybody in the sub-team that may have a better or more complete answer to that.
Okay. All right. In the interest of that, I just wanted to raise that. I may have further written comments, but
yeah.
I don't want to monopolize the conversation here.
Okay. I see Kathy has her hand up and Todd has his hand up. So are either of you responding to Phil's question?
So this is Todd. I'll just go real quick. I was just going, I mean, what you said is correct, and I would agree with that. And then I was just going to add that to the extent that the new language in Section 2 about submitting to the jurisdiction of the court, how that kind of fits in is not clear. I was just going to say I think that's what Kathy's about to talk about.
That's right. So if there's no other questions on that at the moment, let's turn to Kathy. And Kathy, I assume, are you going to walk us through the
no, I was going to raise a different question that may track Phil's. First, I agree with the answer, which is if there is a defense, then the customer is supposed to present it and the provider is supposed to evaluate that. So, Phil, hopefully we took that into account, but, you know, we could always use more eyes looking at that. But one of the questions is, and Subteam 3 does not have an answer to it, and what we're presenting today is not designed to address this. So let me raise it, which is if there is a parallel proceeding going on, do we want to suspend the request? In a UDRP, if someone takes the same action or similar action to court, the UDRP suspends until the end of the court action. And then there's some kind of determination about whether it's appropriate to continue or not. Here, if someone, say, files a motion to quash in the middle of a request, I don't know the answer, but I wanted to raise the question. If there is a UDRP going on at the same time, there's a court action going on at the same time, do we want actions to go on in parallel, or do we want to somehow put them in serial so that one at a time is addressed? And probably it's a good question for the providers. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. If anyone on the sub team in particular, because I don't know if you've discussed this before, if you have an answer to this or
we didn't have time. We kept saying that we wanted more time on this, but we didn't have time.
Okay. Other responses to this? I see Todd's hand up. Todd, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, to the extent, I guess I don't understand the posture of how this might come up. I mean, because obviously this is one of the kind of first steps in the process that, Kathy is outlining. I mean, to the extent that there's a court action, finding the identity of the beneficial owner is going to be a first step in that. So I guess I would ask Kathy, what is the fact pattern where something like this might come up?
Okay. What we're working on today, what the edits have come out with, is if there's a violation after the information is disclosed. So it's been disclosed, and we'll walk through it. But say, for example, the requester, as we know, agrees in an affidavit that they will have restricted use of the information. Say they turn around and they publish it, turn around and harvest it. That's where we're going to talk about options 1 and 2 in Annex 1. But this is a different situation. In the DMCA, if an internet service provider is being asked to turn over the identity of a customer, they will notify the customer, and then the customer may take direct action, go to court, and file what's called a motion to quash, which is I'm going to represent myself through my attorney and say, no, you know, that you don't have the grounds to reveal this. I'm just wondering if a motion to quash is filed, what you know, this is before the requested information is given out. Do we want the ICANN proceeding to prevail over the court proceeding? Do we want the ICANN proceeding to be preempted? I don't think we need an answer now, but this occurred to me as I was working through some of the other issues, and it's also raised, and what Phil says is that, you know, we have all these other proceedings that can come up. What do we want to do? Steve, I would recommend we queue this up, actually, for another time, but this is like an interim. This is like a break in the processing. Do we want to stop it, suspend it, halt it, recognize it, or ignore it? Thanks.
Okay. Look, I see Vicki has her hand up, so let me turn to her.
A couple of things. First, you know, I had mentioned on the sub-team that I think that getting too much into the options in the annex may not be appropriate at the policy level. As James mentioned in his all other business and you know, talking to the implementation team about what's doable and what's not doable, I think this might fall into that camp generally. And you know, moreover, to Kathy's question, I think we've already put into this document everywhere that's all subject to applicable law. I don't think we need to address it any more than that at this stage. Thank you.
Okay, so one answer would be that in that case that the court could obviously freeze the situation, if the provider has jurisdiction over the provider, presumably it would, because otherwise, you know, there wouldn't be a motion to quash unless there was some likelihood that the court would order the provider to do something or not do something. But I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves in terms of the annex to the annex, and I think we wanted to get back to Kathy to walk us through what changes, you know, what we have in front of us here on pages 9 and 10, I guess, of the document. So why don't we, unless there are other questions arising from the material that Todd walked through, why don't we turn to Kathy and ask her to walk us through the annex to the annex, last page or two, and tell us what the sub-team is presenting on that. Kathy?
Terrific. This is Kathy. And this is Annex 1. And we've been reviewing it for, you know, we've been kind of glancing over it for a long time. But no one's really kind of stepped in to edit it, I think, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, I think since almost the beginning of when it was introduced. So it seemed like the right time for sub-team 3 to wrap up its work in full. You know, it seemed to some of us the right time for sub-team 3 to wrap up its work and figure out what to do with Annex 1. And part of this does relate to what James was saying, or at least what I interpret him as saying, which is there's only a limited amount of things we want to send to implementation. We want to make as many decisions as possible on policy issues at our level. So Annex 1 is the disclosure framework, and here we're talking about when there's been a wrongful disclosure of the customer's contact information or an alleged misuse of that information, presumably after it's been disclosed. So this is all after everything. The request templates have been filled out. The provider has processed. The provider has disclosed the requester. There's some allegation of misuse. So we had two options, as you would remember. One was arbitration, that the allegations, controversies, claims, disputes would be sent to arbitration. The other has to do with court actions. So I'll take one at a time. The arbitration, some of us, and this isn't necessarily the sub-team, this is kind of hallway conversations, some of us felt that bumping something to an arbitration system that doesn't yet exist with no further guidance seemed a little vague and may not be appropriate. It would take a lot more discussion to send it to an arbitration. Are we talking about setting up kind of a new UDRP-type arbitration? Is this a whole new structure for ICANN? It raises many, many questions. So the other option, and page all the way down to the bottom, and you get to option 2, jurisdiction. The other option is to let the requesters and the customers and the requesters fight it out themselves. And in which case, where do you do that? And the logical jurisdiction is where the requester or the intellectual property owner can be found, or the location of the provider. And that's what has been an option, too, I think, since the beginning of time. And this is just a clarification of that language consistent with what we see in the UDRP. There was so the original language was, in making a submission to request disclosure of a customer's contact information, requester agrees to be bound by the jurisdiction at the seat of the service provider. More traditional language, and this is what was introduced, requester agrees to submit without prejudice to other potentially applicable jurisdictions to the jurisdictions of the court, one, of your domicile, and two, where the provider is located. So basically where the requester is located or where the provider is located, but using more traditional language than the seat of the service provider, because that's a little vague. And that's the – why don't we talk about that? And if people agree, then we can talk about how we implemented that, you know, with some fairly short language into the main annex. But maybe it's good to stop here.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. I see there are a few hands up. Vicki, is that a new hand? If that is a new hand, please go ahead.
It was an old hand, but it goes to the comment I made earlier about not sure that this is realistic to get into this much detail here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Todd, that's a new hand, I take it, so go ahead.
And just real quick on the clarification, it's not that the two kind of options on the table, one is arbitration and the other is court. Option one, the arbitration does not preclude court. I think the first sentence of the annex talks about, you know, nothing below is prejudicial to whatever other available remedies. So with option two, you get court only, but here are some jurisdictions where that action can go forward. And then with option one, you get court or arbitration, and if you go to court, well, the jurisdictional analysis is just whatever it would be, you know, kind of on its own. I just wanted to point that out.
Okay. Yes, I think it's correct that neither option would take out that first sentence. So, and so I think option two could be, I mean, the first sentence is about neither option is intended to preclude any party from seeking other available remedies at law. So if we have this dispute about a supposed misuse of the data, if you know where the requester is, you can obtain jurisdiction over the requester there. So that's, you know, and that you might have other remedies that would enable you to do that. So really, I think option two is about the second point, as to whether the requester agrees to submit for these disputes to the jurisdiction where the provider is located. I have a question or two about that, but let me just see if there are others who want to raise questions or respond. Actually, my question is really kind of similar to what Mary has in the chat here. It's not domicile necessarily. It's not about option one. It's about option two, where the provider is located. Is that where the provider is incorporated, where the provider receives complaints, where the provider will it always be clear what that jurisdiction is, I guess, is my question, because as I looked at a few of the services recently, it wasn't always clear where they are incorporated. Is that, well, I guess the question is, what's meant by where the provider is located? James points out that in the chat that there may be a difference between the service agreements and where they're incorporated. But I'm really trying to look at this.
Steve, the recommendation would be to parallel this with the UDRP and the registrar, where the registrar is located. However we do
okay.
that.
Okay, and that is
where the provider
on,
is located.
That's listed on
that way the customers
an
have
site. Okay.
The customers have a place certain where they know, just as the requester doesn't want to be forced to sue the customer or go after the customer where the customer is located, since they don't know where the customer is located. Similarly, the customer doesn't want to be bound to go to the ends of the earth to reach the requester, and it's the common jurisdiction is that of the provider.
Okay, my question was just how would the requester know where that is? And in the case of of registrars, that is listed on an ICANN website. You can go there and find out what jurisdiction they, and maybe that could be done as an implementation matter for this too. I see I have a couple of people in the queue, Paul and James. So, Paul, please go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Paul McGrady for the record. A couple of things. One, I do think there is ambiguity, as Steve and James have pointed out, in relationship to the location of the provider. Another example is Tucows, who I believe at least at one point were organs in Pennsylvania, but operate out of Toronto, and I had to, you know, went around in circles on that issue once. And so I do think that the issue, there is confusion as to the jurisdiction themselves. But secondly, most importantly, I'm hesitant to think this is a good idea to essentially parallel this to the UDRP, because one of the things the complainant is getting in the UDRP at the end of the day for rolling the dice on the location of the provider or the location of the registrant is a neutral party addressing this and outcomes that are certain. We don't have that baked into our proposal here. Instead, we could have a provider who's located in someplace far away that maybe doesn't have great courts, not great access, not good predictable outcomes, and high expense of enforcing a enforcing a dispute or going into a dispute in those courts. Again, a registrant who may or may not be where they're ultimately located, and we may not even know ultimately where they're located, right? And so I don't think it's quite the same thing to say that the UDRP and this process have the same level of certainty and outcomes such that a complainant really makes sense for them to consent to a jurisdiction that may be far outside their comfort zone. I, for one, think we should leave it quiet and just simply say, you know, courts of competent jurisdiction, and let the parties battle that out at the time, rather than enshrining this thing in the way that we have in the UDRP. They're just not the same thing. It's an apple and an orange. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. James, and then I have Todd in the queue after that. James,
hi.
Go ahead.
I think Steve, James speaking, and just I think expanding on this a little bit, and I think some of this is going to echo Paul's intervention, that I wouldn't hard code it to jurisdiction of the location of the provider. I think that as we've been discussing, there are a number of reasons why a provider might want to establish a separate location or a separate jurisdiction other than their location, or even perhaps unrelated to where they're incorporated. So just putting that out there, you know, we do require providers to have a service agreement on file, and why don't we just essentially require them to state the jurisdiction, the governing jurisdiction in that agreement, and leave it at that. And I think that allows for the necessary flexibility that I think Paul is going for here, which is saying that establishing a court of competent jurisdiction, and that would be disclosed in the service agreement, and just leave it alone at that.
Okay, thank you, James. Yeah, that would cross reference to something we already have in the in another recommendation. Todd, please go ahead.
So Todd Williams for the transcript, and not necessarily weighing in on either of these, but taking the argument that Kathy was raising before about the first option being that it's not, I guess, fully baked and that there needs to be more to it before we could choose that. I just want to raise a fundamental point, and it may be too late, but I just throw this out there, which is, what exactly does this annex to the annex have to do with the accreditation standards for privacy proxy providers? I mean, if there was nothing here, if there was no annex to the annex, certainly a wronged customer could still pursue either their provider or the requester in whatever court of competent jurisdiction they could establish for whatever remedies they could get the court to give them. And whether we decide on one of these two options or not, or leave it blank, that doesn't change that. And so, I mean, just kind of a fundamental question, if we can't decide on one of these and we just don't put anything in, what is the harm in that case?
Thank you, Todd. Kathy has her hand up, so Kathy, please go ahead.
Okay, Steve, I would recommend this go back to subteam 3 because, you know, pushing this stuff out so quickly, you've heard my complaints about this already, is, you know, there's just not a lot of time to do it. We can spend the hours here in the whole working group, but it's easier if we don't keep getting the message, you know, keep getting the messages in the background that say, push it, push it, push it out. So that's what happens when we do, which is that we're still talking about really, really important issues. And critical issues are, you know, we heard in 21,000 comments that this data can be misused, and that misuse will cause doxing, swatting, and a parade of horribles that we don't have to go into. And the question is, what's the remedy for the customer whose life may have been totally turned upside down? And the remedy might be to sue the person who requested the data, promised that they would only use it for limited purposes, and blogged it the next day. And something got turned upside down. Somebody got arrested. Somebody got flogged. Somebody, you know, keep going. So just as requesters want a level of certainty, whoever drafted this annex initially was right to say that customers need to be able to know that there's a place certain that they can seek remedies if their data has been abused, and the logical place is, however we define it, consistent with the UDRP, that you can go to the provider. The reason James Bodell's answer doesn't work is that the service agreement only binds the customer, it doesn't bind the requester. So we need to find some way to bind the requester as they come into the process that says, yes, if you abuse what you've agreed to, you know, there's a jurisdiction where someone can sue you that's easily reachable and knowable up front. And that's fair. And that's balanced. And frankly, I think it's consistent with 21,000 comments that we heard. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Kathy. I have Stephanie and then Vicki.
Thank you.
Stephanie, go ahead.
Thanks. I hope you can hear me. Stephanie Perrin for the record.
I can.
I'm responding. Hello?
Go ahead.
You can? Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm responding to the question, what's the harm? And Kathy has answered part of that. I think the harm that I just want to emphasize, and I apologize for my clock going off in the background, is that the beneficial end user is in a complete power imbalance in this situation. And therefore, if we just leave it, they are not likely, even if the infringement involved is not as serious as Kathy has outlined, but in any situation, they are not going to know how to sue these folks unless they are seasoned internet UDRP type users. And most of the people we're worrying about as consumers are not. So I think it's really important that there be some kind of effort to right that power imbalance. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. Vicki, you're next. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'd like to remind everyone that we have already put in several protections into Annex E to address those concerns. There's the pretext concept. There's the safety concept. There's the fact that the requester has to give their full name and information about how to contact them. So, you know, the question of do they know where to sue the requester? Yeah, they do, because the requester is supposed to identify themselves, you know, with particularity. So we've addressed a lot of these issues, I believe, already. That is why I think going down this path does us a disservice. There is the ability to sue. We've already said that. None of this precludes that. I understand Stephanie's point about these people may not know how to sue, which is why I've got those other built-in protections already there. And, you know, quite frankly, I think going down option 2 is not the right way to go. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Vicki. I'm not hearing a consensus outcome here. Let me just pick up on one thing that Todd said that may be important here is to how this fits in with an accreditation process. So the option 1, I can see how that fits because the provider has to agree and the request, you know, basically everyone agrees that they can go to arbitration. Option 2 is apparently just the requester agreeing to submit to jurisdiction. Obviously, again, the first option where the requester is domiciled, that's already a given that they're subject to jurisdiction there. But it's really the number two, and there is a question about disclosure of this. That's obviously a solvable problem, I think, but there would need to be some way of making it clear to the requester at the time it makes the request what it's signing up to in terms of jurisdiction. I think everyone would agree with that. But I guess there is the question of in the absence of this, in the absence of option two, I guess the only difference is whether the customer could bring a lawsuit in the jurisdiction of the provider and obtain jurisdiction over the requester. I think that's the only additional element here. So that's kind of the marginal value for the requester, for the customer, is that. So if the customer has his registration through Namecheap and uses WhoisGuard, Namecheap is a U.S. registrar. WhoisGuard is a Panamanian company. So this would enable the customer, if he feels that the information has been misused, to sue the requester in Panama and know that it wouldn't encounter jurisdictional obstacles there. That's the example that I see. Or within the United States, it may create a different jurisdiction in a state court or something like that, or in which federal court should get the case. So that, I think, is what we're talking about here. So we need to figure out whether we need to resolve that in order to provide that additional marginal comfort for the customer who feels that the information that was disclosed was misused. I don't think we've reached a conclusion on this, but I would ask people to try to think about this and see first whether they feel this is necessary to address this, and second, if so, then how should we be tweaking option two to make it clear? Two points, really. One is that there is some way for the requester to know what jurisdiction he or she is submitting to. And second, the other point I would make is that it probably should say solely for the purpose of disputes arising from alleged improper disclosures, et cetera, because it's not a general, I agree to be sued by the customer for anything in this jurisdiction. It's just for certain types of allegations. So unless people do people have other comments on this question or suggestions about how we might resolve this, I think we've gotten some of the issues out on the table here, and I appreciate everyone's participation in that. Okay, I don't see anybody else in the queue. So let me just ask Subteam 3, so we basically covered the main changes that were made here. Are there any other points that any of the Subteam 3 people wish to bring up at this time? Okay, if not, let me turn to James B., who had an all-other business question about implementation specificity. Well, I don't want to characterize it. So, James, why don't you go ahead and raise your concern and your suggestion about how we should proceed on this?
Thanks, Steve. James speaking. And it's just something I posted to the list. I was thinking about coming back from Dublin during the face-to-face, and I readily acknowledge that I only attended the last couple of hours of that session. I had a conflict, but during the face-to-face, I think I heard a number of, maybe challenges is a strong word, but let's say open questions with regard to implementation and how
this accreditation framework, not just the rule set around accreditation, but just how it's actually going to be put into practice and some of the, I guess, operational concerns of rolling this out to existing privacy services, to new privacy services that may want to start up under this new framework, and how ICANN is going to police and govern all of that. And I thought that, you know, as we start to come in for a landing on our final report and some of the recommendations start to take shape, and maybe we're not there yet, but it seems that the time is fast approaching where we want to hand this over to staff, whether that's some combination of GDD staff as well as ICANN compliant, and ask them to weigh in while the window to modify the report is still open, and ask them to kind of weigh in on the implementation challenges that they anticipate with each of these recommendations, and whether or not they can identify any alternatives that are already in practice that can be leveraged to develop some new models. So I think that Mary's putting something here in the window here, but just a thought that, you know, if we're not there yet, we should probably be thinking about this as we get closer to a read through of our final report and final recommendations before we absolutely close the window on the text. And I'm just for a little bit of background, I'm raising this because of the experiences that I and a number of others had with regard to the implementation of a couple of transfer PDPs, which, you know, on the surface, and certainly when they went through the PDP, through council and through board, seemed fairly straightforward. But once they entered the implementation phase, got bogged down in a number of very, very tricky, concerns that were unaddressed from the PDP. And that took somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 to 18 months just to implement a couple of tweaks to a transfer policy. And here we're talking about a whole new accreditation program created out of whole cloth. I worry that we're setting ourselves up for a heavy lift on the implementation side of this equation that's going to drag out, you know, a number of years. And I just think that we should do what we can to head that off.
Okay, thank you, James. Any responses to that? I don't know if the staff has anything they would like to say about this. Yeah, I see Mary's hand is up, so Mary, please go ahead.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks, James, for raising the topic. It is pretty important that we get this coordinated early. So to that extent, when our initial report was drafted, the Registrar Services team as well as compliance was asked to look at it, and what you see on the screen is a document that I think was most recently sent around to the working group just after Dublin. This is a summary of the operational concerns that they had with the initial report, or at least the recommendations, not per se, but as phrased. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that for the draft final report, we have tried to change some of the language through some edits or some clarifications to try to address some of these that seem more policy-oriented. So on that score, I think all the staff from policy to operations would ask the working group to look at the draft final report language with that in mind to see if, corresponding with this list, there's more that needs to be done, or whether on the policy side we've done it sufficiently. Obviously, then on the third thing, when we have that final report circulated, well, we had, that was also sent to the operations staff. So we hope to have them sort of do another go around, at least of the actual phrasing of the recommendations. And some of you know Amy Bivens, she was at the Dublin meeting. She's been regularly attending our meetings as well, so we've been in contact with her. That doesn't mean, of course, to say that we shouldn't do what James is suggesting. And so to that end, Amy and Mike Zupke have offered to be available and possibly come on a call if it's helpful to talk it through. The only caveat to all of this, I would say, is that given the timeline, we'll probably want to do this pretty quickly. And so maybe Glam, Don, and Steve, we need to coordinate on that. But hopefully some of this sort of background information as to where this document came from and how we've tried to deal with it in the draft final report is helpful.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Yeah, so this document that you've put up here is relating to the report that was put out for public comment. We now have, well, we have a near final version that we circulated before Dublin, and it would be, if you look through this, some of these things have been addressed, some haven't. And in fairness to James's point, he didn't have the document on deaccreditation that we just circulated last night, and I think that helps address some of these issues, but again, I'm sure it doesn't address all of the issues. So, I think the time is now, actually, for if we're going to get further staff input, and I think this document that's on the screen right now has been a little bit overtaken by events, but it could become the basis for other issues that they flag. But I guess my question would be, and we can discuss this further among the co-chairs and so forth with the staff, is let's distinguish between points where there's something in a policy recommendation that would impede implementation and others, you know, like, you know, there are other questions here that are more strictly implementation questions I don't think we have to deal with. But anyway, that's my only observation on that. James, why don't you have your hand up, so please go ahead.
Thanks, Steve. Just a quick follow-up, and thanks, Mary. This is excellent, and I think this document is, as Steve said, I think we've probably covered some of these items, but a number of them still remain open. I think it's a good point, but what I had envisioned was maybe even a little more comprehensive than this. Rather than just identifying questions, I think it would be helpful to the group, if staff were to come back and say, you know, here's recommendation one, we don't see any issues with this. Here's recommendation two, you know, we see that this is, you know, let's call it a medium task, degree of difficulty, and here are some options, and here's, item three, which is probably more difficult, and here are some other options, and just kind of laying out some choices because, my concern here is that we are under the gun. I understand that we are trying to get this final report delivered. My concern is that if we can invest, a little bit more time on this, it's going to save us months in the implementation if we can address these questions on the front end. And I think that's understood. So I'm encouraged by this, and I would urge us to get moving on it as quickly as we can. Thanks.
Okay, we'll take this up further, and we're really up to just about out of time here, but we are aiming to get the final version of the final report circulated as soon as possible. So on both of the topics that we discussed today, I would encourage people to get on the list and present. You know, if you have any questions about the deaccreditation document, or if you have views on this annex to the annex issue in the illustrative disclosure framework, please get those on the list this week, so that we can try to come to a resolution and folding those things into our final report. I think we're about out of time here, so I will stop here and just thank everybody for their participation, and look forward to speaking to all of you next Tuesday, if not sooner. Thank you.